Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, Ali is away this week, so it's just me bringing you up to speed with this week's headlines. Coming up, net migration into the UK hit a record 906,000 in the year to June 2023, much higher than previously estimated. So, is Labour failing on its promise to get these numbers down? We'll also discuss how Britain is failing its children who require special education needs or disability support in schools, and what the government must do to prevent them falling further behind their peers. As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
There's a petition out there, 2 million people asking him to go. He's the one who doesn't know. He's the one who doesn't know how things work. It is not government that creates growth, Mr. Speaker. It is business. His employment secretary, I don't see her here, she wants more young people in work. But businesses say they are cutting jobs because of the Chancellor's budget.
And she talks about a petition. We had a massive petition on the 4th of July in this country. Years taking our party from a party of protest to a party of government, they're hurtling in the opposite direction.
So Keir Starmer has ruled out an early general election after a petition calling for a second vote reached close to 3 million signatures. Now, the petition was launched over the weekend and says there should be another vote just 4 months after Labour won their landslide because they have, quote, gone back on the promises they laid out in the lead up to the last election. By Monday morning, it had reached 2 million signatures and was climbing fast. Petitions on the government website are considered for debate by MPs after 10,000 signatures. Petitions get a government response after the tally reaches 100,000. Over the weekend, MPs considered to be from the right of the Tories or from Reform UK were urging people on social media to sign the petition. The PM said he was, quote, not surprised those who did not support Labour wanted a second vote, but that isn't how our system works. Well, joining me on the programme to discuss this and some of the week's other major stories is Natalie Balmain, who won the Channel 4 series Make Me a Prime Minister and is the host of the brand new podcast Typecast. Thanks for joining me, Natalie. Tell me, what do you make of this petition?
I don't want to discredit any of the reasons why any member of the public would sign this petition. I'm sure a lot of them are looking for swifter action on the economy and on jobs. However, I do believe it's more complicated than that. And I know we're going to talk about this in another one of our stories. I would argue that the opposing parties at this point are just looking to win and don't have a better viable plan for fixing the economy. In fact, I hate to be the Grinch before Christmas, but I would argue it's almost inevitable at this point that our economy is going to completely collapse. And we'll get into that in more detail in another story. But, of course, like I said, I can understand absolutely why people are voting for a petition. But I really don't think that it's going to solve the problems that they want it to solve. And I don't think that the Labour Party, Reform UK, or the Tories have a viable plan to answer the public's concerns.
Do you think maybe we're being a little bit kind of harsh and a little bit rushed? Because, you know, the brand new Labour government, they've been out of power for 14 years and they've only been in power now for 4 months.
Yeah.
Progress doesn't happen overnight. I mean, how long should we give the government before we all force a new general election? Or do you think, actually, you would have hoped there would have been more progress far quicker by now?
I mean, no, I absolutely don't think there can be any measurable progress, or not any that the public can feel in their pocket within the space of 4 or 5 months. I really don't think that's possible. I think we have terms for a reason. And I think that's because that's really, I would argue, even possibly the shortest amount of time, 4 years, to be able to really make effective change. I can understand we've had 14 years of Tory rule. We've essentially more or less been in recession since 2008. A huge amount of people's careers and lives have been stunted as a result of this. But it's not going to be a quick fix overnight, I'm afraid. And there's a huge, huge number of contributing factors and not all that are within the control of just our government. Mm.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, expecting any government to turn around what has been 14 years of austerity and decay in the space of 4 months is a bit ridiculous. I also think, you know, there are conversations about some of the wording in Labour's manifesto, for example. So they said they wouldn't, you know, raise national insurance contributions. And obviously they have for employers. And there's lots of argument about whether that means Labour were dishonest. I think people kind of bake into their consideration of MPs that sometimes they may go back on their word. And, you know, people call these U-turns, they might call them lies. I mean, isn't this part of actually grown-up politicking that sometimes plans change and you do have to, you know, when you open the books, you might have to change your mind on some things?
Absolutely. I mean, I think even I, at one point in my life, was guilty of believing that, you know, people should stick by what we might consider their morals or their principles. But once you actually make it into government, it's a much more difficult situation than just that. Mm. And like I said a second ago, there are so many external contributing factors in terms of our stance globally, in terms of, you know, how we're trying to approach deals and partnerships with other countries and get investment into this country, which all, you know, it all comes at a cost. And yeah, I really just think it's when it comes to how a lot of politics is portrayed in the media, it's oversimplified at best.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Let's just briefly touch on this before we move on to the next topic, because I think this is significant and it really irritates me. OK, Donald Trump aide Elon Musk, that's going to take some getting used to as a phrase, who is also, incidentally, the billionaire owner of X, reposted a link to this petition, which got 200,000 signatures in a few hours, writing, "Wow, why is Musk interfering in British politics?"
I mean, I think it, to put it as simply as I can, this man has a nefarious self-interest in public affairs. Mm. That's it. I would be very, very wary of anything that Elon Musk endorses. You know, he claims in one way to sort of be against the Kabul elite. He is the Kabul elite. Mm. This is a man who is the biggest receiver of government contracts in the US. He's also the biggest financial lobbyist of the US government. And now he's got himself a position in US government. If that's not a conflict of interest, I absolutely don't know what is.
Mm. Natalie, are you on X still? Or have
no
you ever
longer,
been?
No. I switched to Blue Sky. I have no interest in, you know, in poisoning my brain with the absolute nonsense and just disgusting sort of rhetoric that is on X now that he's endorsed and encouraged.
You and me both. Okay, well, now to perhaps one of the reasons why people are calling for a general election: people's wages.
I know that for working people up and down our country, family finances are stretched and paychecks don't go as far as they once did. So today I am taking steps to support people with the cost of living. It was the Labour government that introduced the national minimum wage in 1999. It had a transformative impact on the lives of working people. As promised in our manifesto, we asked the Low Pay Commission to take account of the cost of living for the first time. I can confirm that we will accept the Low Pay Commission recommendation to increase the national living wage by 6.7% to £12.21 an hour.
That was Rachel Reeves during her budget speech last month. But a new report suggests workers in Britain are worse off than they were in 2008 before the financial crisis, as the country lags behind the rest of the rich world. The financial crisis, COVID pandemic and the cost of living squeeze have combined with dire productivity and weak economic growth to give British workers one of the worst blows to living standards. Among advanced economies in the G20, the world's richest nations, only workers in Japan and Italy have suffered on a similar scale over the past decade and a half, according to the International Labour Organization. And it underlines quite the scale of the challenge facing Sir Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves as the Prime Minister seeks to make Britain the fastest growing economy in the G7. Natalie, you touched on this earlier, but what in your view has gone wrong with the UK economy so we're still less well off than we were in 2008?
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a complex issue, so I'm going to try and cover as much of this as I possibly can in the time that we've got. But in 2007, just to give you some statistics, we had a slightly higher GDP per capita than the USA. We now have barely 60% of the USA. So to give you some figures, our GDP per capita stands at about $46,000 compared to the USA's $76,000. Even the USA's poorest state, Mississippi, has a GDP per capita at $48,000. So we are technically poorer than Mississippi. Again, you look at the stock indexes, our FTSE stock index has grown 25% since the start of the century. The USA's S&P has grown 250%, so 10 times that. We have had virtually no economic growth since 2008. And there's a huge amount of reasons for that. Of course, the global recession of 2008 comes into play, the COVID pandemic and the Russia-Ukraine war. But the fact is that, as you mentioned, by 2023, the UK was the only country in the G7 to be in decline. So what is the difference? Well, the difference is our financial industry, to put it as bluntly as I possibly can. We have a two-tier economy here in the UK, and that's because we are so heavily reliant on the London financial sector for our productivity. 40 to 50% of our investment goes there, and income there is triple that of other parts of London and other parts of the UK. And the rise of our financial sector has basically come at the cost of our other sectors, our industry and our trade. We've been in a trade decline over the last century, but mostly so over the last 20 years. And because of that, and because of the demand in our financial sector, our pound has been overvalued, which further doesn't help our other industries, because it basically makes our other industries uncompetitive. Essentially, exports are dear and imports are cheaper. And so to put it into a sort of rolling loop for you, we have this oversized financial industry, which came at a cost of our other industries and our trade, and our pound was overvalued, which made us more reliant on our financial industry for our productivity. And then what happened in 2008? Well, the crash mainly affected the financial industry, and so the government bailed them out. Mm. And of course, this increased government debt. Now, what happens when we have huge government debt? And by the way, we have some of the largest government debt we've ever had, certainly in the last 100 years. We then have austerity. Now, austerity means cuts to our education, to our public sector, and lower wages. And of course, if we are looking to increase our productivity in other industries other than the financial sector, austerity doesn't help. Government debt doesn't help, because we're not skilling our workers enough. We've made cuts to education. We're not able to attract high quality immigration, because why would they come here when our wages are low and our public sector, our public services are rubbish? So we're not actually helping ourselves to build up that trade position. And of course, before the other recent crises came into play, Britain made another choice, which I think
going to ask you about this.
And that's Brexit.
Brexit, of course, yeah.
When you have a poor trading position, then removing yourself from a free trade circle is frankly ludicrous. For companies who are doing business in Europe, their costs increase to trade with us. 440 financial firms then moved their staff out of the UK, and 1.4 trillion was moved out of British holding banks into European accounts. I really do feel like we've kind of put ourselves in this, what do they call it when somebody's free falling and they go into that spin of death?
Death spiral.
Death spiral. We are essentially in a death spiral, because the government, and this is why I said in the previous story, I don't think any party has a viable plan to fix this, because they have two choices. They can either further decrease spending, which I don't think they've got much more room to do, or they can increase tax rates, which I don't think they've got much more room to do. So what is the way out? What is the way out?
You did the unthinkable there, Natalie, and actually made me understand economics. So that is very, very impressive. Okay, we're going to move on to our final story. This is a story that continues to divide Parliament.
I haven't supported it before on the basis that I'd always worried about vulnerable people being put under pressure. Once you have some form of assisted dying, what's the pressure put on people by relatives? I've always had that worry and concern. But I have to say, over the years of watching this debate and listening to the passionate arguments that people have put forward, having also known people with things like motor neurone disease and seen the deterioration and know how awful the end can be, I'm very much, I've got an open mind and I'm thinking.
That was former Prime Minister David Cameron, who has backed moves to legalise the assisted dying bill for terminally ill adults. In an article in the Times newspaper, Lord Cameron said that while he had opposed moves to legalise assisted dying in the past, he believed the current proposal was, quote, not about ending life, it is about shortening death. Previously, his main concern had been that vulnerable people could be pressured into hastening their own deaths, but he said he believed the current proposal contained sufficient safeguards to prevent this. Lord Cameron becomes the first former Prime Minister to support the bill after Gordon Brown, Theresa May, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss have all said they were against it. The bill is splitting MPs, where currently slightly more have publicly said that they will support it, but more than half have not revealed which way they plan to vote, making the result difficult to predict. Natalie, why is this such a divisive issue for MPs?
I think it's like any issue that is divisive among MPs. They're cautiously treading, to keep favour in the court of public opinion, essentially. You know, it's much easier for Cameron to have a stance on this now. He's not in power. I'm sure he's got no aspiration to be Prime Minister again. So he's in a slightly easier position to make it. And I think that, you know, the trend in terms of public support is growing, and I think he's onto that. And so he's voiced his change of heart. And look, I'm not saying that people can't have a change of heart, and I'm not saying that, you know, perhaps he does find the bill has safety measures that are okay now. But if I was being more cynical, I would also say that previously his stance on this was when he was less concerned about the economic death spiral. And the fact is now, I think he could possibly be going, okay, if people want to do it, let's just let them do it. Cynically, and this is dreadful to say, he might even be thinking, well, save the NHS some money.
That's interesting. We know this is a really difficult topic for a lot of MPs, and the MPs I've spoken to, I think a lot of their concerns are that, as you say, the NHS is not in a position at the minute, or they feel it is not in a position at the minute, to support this kind of legislation. And because if people aren't getting appropriate palliative care or appropriate social care when they have when they're terminally ill or when they are in a lot of pain, they are worried that there will be an element of almost coercion there, you know, involuntarily wanting to change your circumstances because the NHS cannot care for people in the way it should. I guess the concern for those who do support this bill and maybe are worried about the safeguards or the state of the NHS is that they might not get another shot at this. And, you know, public opinion does seem to be or has been historically overwhelmingly in favour of legalising assisted death. Do you think that if MPs don't pass this bill, they will have lost the opportunity to do so for a long time?
Yeah, I do. And I think that that's possibly another reason why a lot of them are treading carefully, because I think there are more factors in play for them, as you said, in terms of health and social care, than they want to perhaps admit. But I think it would be a real shame if the public weren't listened to on this, because at the end of the day, this is something that shouldn't really... Okay, yeah, obviously the legality of it is a government decision, but this is something the government really doesn't need to make a moral decision on. This is something that is an individual's and a family's moral decision.
Okie doke. Well, thank you so much, Natalie. That was The Week Unwrapped. Thanks to Natalie Balmain, who won the Channel 4 series Make Me a Prime Minister. I think you'd be an excellent Prime Minister, Natalie, and host of the brand new podcast Typecast. Thank you again for joining me on the programme. Okay, coming up, as net migration hit a record 906,000 in the year to June 2023, much higher than previously estimated, is Labour failing on its promise to get these numbers down? That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Access. Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister.
That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
cray,
truth.
Cray.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, let's have a listen to the Prime Minister addressing the nation a little earlier.
The Independent Office of National Statistics has conducted vital work on the state of immigration and found the previous government were running an open borders experiment. As the ONS sets out, nearly 1 million people came to Britain in the year ending June 2023. That is four times the migration levels compared with 2019. Time and again, the Conservative Party promised they would get the numbers down. Time and again, they failed. And now the chorus of excuses has begun. We heard that from the Leader of the Opposition yesterday. But what we didn't hear, what the British people are owed, is an explanation. Because a failure on this scale isn't just bad luck. It isn't a global trend or taking your eye off the ball. No, this is a different order of failure. This happened by design, not accident.
That was Keir Starmer speaking a little earlier today. Now, net migration into the UK has hit a record 906,000 in the year to June 2023, much higher than previously estimated official figures show. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, originally said it was 740,000, but have now revised this figure upwards by 166,000. The ONS said it had significantly underestimated the number of immigrants staying in the UK for longer than 12 months and has now improved its processes.
annual net migration, the difference between those entering and leaving the country, now stands at 728,000. The ONS said net migration had been running at historically high levels because of the war in Ukraine and post-Brexit visa rules, which were brought in by Boris Johnson's government. And as you heard there, the Prime Minister has accused the Tories of using Brexit to deliberately run an open borders experiment in the UK while they were in power. Well, joining me on the programme to discuss this is Sunda Katwala, Director of British Future, an immigration and integration think tank. Thank you so much for joining us, Sunda. Let's start by just asking, why do the figures continue to be so high?
We've got high immigration for sure in these figures. Historically, we've been running net migration 250,000, 300,000 for most of the century up till 2019. I think the peak in immigration 2022, 2023 is partly by design, it's partly by accident. It is a decision at the end of European free movement to have a more liberal policy to non-European immigration. Boris Johnson was doing that deliberately. He didn't know the numbers that would come from that. It's partly deliberate because when there was a war in Ukraine and when there was a crisis in Hong Kong, the government thought that we should have immigration from those countries and play our part. And when Afghanistan fell, and that was a cross-partisan political issue. I think the Labour opposition, the Conservative government thought we should do those things. It was actually quite publicly popular. And those were exceptional events that meant we had one-off spikes of immigration. We've also got high student immigration in this country. And there was a popular bipartisan policy to have graduate visas again so students can stay. And the Boris Johnson government, the Rishi Sunak government, the Keir Starmer opposition agreed on this and the public supported it. So immigration's high because we choose to have immigration. Asylum is a different issue where, you know, we want to protect refugees, but we're less in control of the numbers. But this is, while it's surprisingly high, even the politicians who made the decisions, this is the obvious consequence, higher, not lower, of the decisions that were made.
And as you say, this is a, you know, political choice to have these kind of levels. So why is it that the ONS could have got this figure quite drastically wrong in the first place?
Well, it's hard to target net migration. We actually knew before these figures, we knew what the visa number was. It was 1.25 million. We didn't really know what the emigration rate is. Because you or I or a student from India who's graduated or somebody who's come from Ukraine can leave the country and we can estimate those things, but we don't have outward visa checks of the same kind. So that's where a lot of the fluctuation comes from. Apart from those exceptional events, there is some distortion in the student numbers because of the pandemic and different people coming and so on. So we'll also, Keir Starmer kind of, you know, making some political points because these are the figures up till the week before the election. So there's nothing of Keir Starmer in these numbers. These are all Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. So he's making his political points. It's obviously not true that we have an open borders policy, but we had a more liberal policy for students, and we had a more liberal policy. So that's what's happened. Some of it, for example, dependence with students, and the government made later changes. They weren't expecting the numbers they got using the rules they set up.
Do you think it's politically wise for Keir Starmer to, you know, accuse the Prime Minister, accuse the Tories of running an open borders experiment, putting these high figures at the previous administration's door? Because obviously then he is sort of setting out his stall to reduce those figures. I mean, is that possible? Do you think he'll be able to do that? Or do you think he might be, putting an albatross around his own neck?
He's scoring political points. And in a sense, he's got some right to do so, because from 2010 to 2019, the Conservatives told us the target was net 100,000. Labour was never in favour of that target, but the Conservatives obviously didn't meet it. Boris Johnson, when he was liberalising, didn't believe in a numbers target, scrapped it, and then said it'll be lower than it is, net 250. Now, Keir Starmer is chancing it a bit, but he's actually got something lucky on his side here, which is that all he said is we'll have lower numbers than the numbers we inherit. And today we find out what that number is, net 720,000. He doesn't need to make any policy changes now to get it drifting back towards the kind of 400,000 level. So I think the challenge for Keir Starmer, while, you know, he's using open borders language because the Conservatives like to say that about Labour, so he's doing that as a jibe. The challenge for Keir Starmer, I think, is as the numbers do drop a bit to quite a high level, he should explain that he doesn't share Kemi Badenoch's view or Nigel Farage's view that the aim is to get net zero or net 100,000. And he actually needs to tell us what he's trying to do, because trying to stay below net 700,000 won't be difficult. Deciding whether or not if it's net 400,000, your policy is to reduce or your policy is to balance the different things. I think he needs an explanation of that. It's fine to knock the Conservatives with doing the opposite of what they promised, but he's actually now got to set out what he wants to pledge to do himself.
Obviously, our economy is pretty dependent on labour from migrants. How dependent is it? I understand it's quite a difficult question to quantify, but is that problematic for the government that we are very dependent on immigration to keep ticking over economically? And what should the government, how should the government juggle that with demands to get migration down?
I think you can take this seriously because the public actually have quite a serious balance of view. There are pressures of migration. It won't be sustained at this rate, but it'd be very hard to run a good housing policy if it really was 700,000 every year forever. Can you sustain net 300,000 or so on? Well, you can if you're managing it well, but you need a housing policy that fits that, and we haven't had one. And then you need to think about the services and so on. So, I mean, the public overestimate how easy it is to cut because they massively overestimate how big a share asylum is. Asylum is 8% of these numbers, but the channel crossing bit of asylum is visibly uncontrolled. People are very in favour of the Ukraine bit of refugee policy and the Hong Kong humanitarian visas and so on. So in terms of what are the underlying causes of high migration, a bigger share of the international student market is good if we're handling it well in the places students come to. Needing lots and lots of people for social care because no one wants to do the job because we don't pay it properly, that's bad. And we need a social care funding model. We'll still want people to be migrants in social care, and we should treat them well and value the fact that they've came. In the NHS, which is the most popular form of migration in this country, I think people are probably right that we want a better balance, but it would take time to bring it in. But they're always going to be absolutely in favour of the NHS visas we need to cut the waiting list. So there are, I think, examples where governments of both parties and businesses have used migration as a short-term tool to not deal with the medium-term problems. I think social care is the really obvious one. And it's not being pro or anti-migration to say let's treat the well the people who come to Britain, but actually strike a right balance. But there might be other areas where, you know, why would you want a limit on student migration as long as you can handle the housing? We want to grow that market. It's worth 30 or 40 billion pounds to this country and to local and regional economies.
And that's really interesting. So, I mean, obviously housing is a massive point of contention in this country for many reasons, and it often is the thing that's sort of thrown up as, you know, we don't have enough housing in this country, so how can we support a larger migrant population? But as you say, there are certain industries that are very, very dependent on migrant labour. I noted that you talked about the NHS. What about hospitality? I mean, we saw a real lack of hospitality staff after Brexit. Is that beginning to turn around? Have we seen more of an influx into those hospitality roles? And how dependent is that industry on migration?
Well, what you have got with the new system is you've got quite high migration, and, you know, graduates can stay and do work at different levels. But you've got other industries. If you're paying at a lower level, there are people who've been cut out of the migration system. They've got to adapt. They've got to adapt in different ways. So there are, you know, pros and cons and pressures and gains. We make special provision for sort of agriculture, you know, which is a low paid job that nobody wants their kids to do, and nobody with rights to work in other things tends to want to do that. So that's a migration thing. Hospitality, if you're more flexible around the worker, you're more flexible around young workers, you know, there is youth unemployment in this country and so on, you could strike a better balance. And I think it's reasonable for the government to look at what industries are saying of, you know, can they have, you know, routes and so on. But I do think you want to make sure that they've done everything they can, that the employer is flexible for the worker, people with caring responsibilities who are parents and young people, you know, can do more of these jobs if you're flexible to them. So I think there's a balance to be struck there about the different ways to deal with it. And sometimes I think it will drive pay up. Sometimes, but not if you're expecting, you know, migration controls to do everything.
Would you say it's fair to say that Brexit has, rather than giving us back control over our migration policy, do you think it's actually had a more kind of negative impact on our ability to control migration?
No, we've got more control, except in the case of, you know, asylum when it's coming on small boats, mm-hmm. and that's a challenging issue. Some of that's to do with Brexit. We can make deals with France. We've got more control. And the interesting thing about having more control is what do you do with it? So you can complain about free movement and say it was all about Brussels, you didn't have any rules. We had more control. And we decided that in the case of the NHS and the social care visas and the IT workers and almost every category you could think of, that actually we wanted people rather than not wanting people. So it's up to us to set policies for all of these things. The public and the politicians see the dilemmas of control. It's been said, you know, Home Secretaries are sitting around the cabinet saying, you know, I'm going to make a speech about reduced migration. And every other one of their colleagues is saying, that's fine, but, you know, don't forget about the farmers and hospitals and social care. And the public take this really seriously. I think the housing issue is real. Half of housing demand comes from immigration. Half of it comes from social change. If we're, instead of promising to cut immigration and not doing it, actually having the housing policy we need for the migration we've got and the society we've got is the biggest kind of practical thing that you can do. And then you can make choices. Do you want to really reduce student migration and have higher fees or fewer universities? Or do you think we can handle that well? The social care issue, I think, needs fixing. And cutting off migration would make it worse, but it needs fixing whether you've got migration or you haven't. So I think a more serious debate about the actual policy issues that are involved would be much better than slogans, soundbites, and, you know, in a sense, when people say there's a bit of betrayal going on, by accident and by design, there was really, because a government that was saying it would cut immigration had a policy to increase it.
I just want to ask you quickly, last question, Sunder, if that's okay. There is concerns from some, particularly on the left, that if Keir Starmer continues to talk about immigration, he raises the salience of it and it becomes a bigger and trickier political issue for him. How do you think Keir Starmer should approach the issue of immigration in terms of how much he talks about it and in, you know, what sort of tone he talks about it?
I disagree with the idea that the left should avoid the issue, because I think you leave a vacuum to the right if you avoid it. What I would like to see him do by next spring, and the numbers will come down to quite a high level, like net 400,000, I'd like to see him lean into this issue about what choices do we want to make. Let's have a day that looks like the budget. He can tell us what he's doing on all of the policies, why the balance is, what we're doing about public services, where there's rising population. Nigel Farage can put down an amendment in Parliament and say it should be net zero. I wouldn't have any of the choices you'd made. And you can defend your choices. I would do that because the middle of the public that gets crowded out of the media and the online debate really is where Keir Starmer and his government are, that we actually value the contribution that migration makes, but we've actually got the challenge of handling it well. And so I think running away from the salients, that isn't being Rishi Sunak and making promises on levels or promises on stopping the boats that you can't deliver. The big message to Keir Starmer is, if you want to keep promises on migration, don't make promises you can't keep about the level, but share with people the reason you've made the decisions you have. So I'd say talk about it more from the middle, where, you know, lots of Liberal people have voted Labour and aren't particularly worried about high migration, even if they think, you know, this level is very high. A small number of people who voted Labour, you know, would like considerable reductions. Most of the people who want really, really lower migration aren't in the universe of people who might vote for the Labour Party. They're debating whether to vote Tory or Reform. You can give those people a respectful hearing and see if they've got a plan to cut the numbers that, you know, does all the things we need to do. But so I think he should own his centre-left position and talk about managing it well and talk about managing the impact well.
Thank you very much. That was Sunder Kutwala, Director of British Future, an immigration and integration think tank. OK, coming up, Britain is failing its children who require special education needs or disability support in schools, according to a damning new report by the local government ombudsman. So who's at fault and what needs to change? Well, we'll discuss that and more next.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister.
That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you. What's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
cray,
truth.
Cray.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Politics Uncensored on Fubar Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, England's special education system is failing, causing thousands of children to have their development put back by months or even years, according to a damning report by the local government ombudsman. Amardeep Samal, the local government and social care ombudsman, said her caseload was now dominated by complaints from families involving special education needs provision and schools, with more than 90% of complaints being upheld. Complaints about schools and special needs provision accounted for 26% of the local government ombudsman cases in 2023-24, with 92% upheld. A situation where we are upholding nearly 100% of complaints cannot be one that is working for children and their families, Samal said. A key failing was the inability of many councils to even process applications because of a lack of funding, facilities or qualified staff. Well, joining us to discuss the question around special educational needs in the UK is Rob Webster, a writer in the field of special educational needs and disabilities and the author of the book The Inclusion Illusion, How Children with Special Educational Needs Experience Mainstream Schools. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rob. Can you start by just telling us what is SEND provision and why is it important?
Hello, Zoe. So SEND provision affects about 16% of the school population in England. And essentially, it's a sort of two-tier structure. You have about a million of children who are on what's called SEND support. So these are children who have an identified special educational need. And it's kind of recognised that they need some kind of additional support or provision to be made available in their school. So these are generally children who are attending mainstream schools. And there's a tier of about a fifth of those children overall And they are the ones with the kind of more acute and complex needs, and they are they have what's called an education, health and care plan, or an EHCP, and this is a legal document. There's a whole assessment process behind it, which recognises the complexity of their needs and puts in place a more specialised provision in order to meet those needs. And in a lot of cases, or that will be attending a special school. So essentially, all the children in special schools in England will have one of these EHCPs.
And can you tell us a little bit about what is going wrong with it in this country? I mean, I've got my pile of papers here, and there's just terrible headline after terrible headline about the SEND crisis being, you know, extraordinary and affecting so many children. Can you talk to us a little bit about what has gone wrong and when it sort of started?
Yes, well, I mean, your pile of papers there, Zoe. I mean, these reports are stacking up, to be honest. This latest one from the Ombudsman is one of, many that have come out in recent years. Essentially, the system's never been perfect. What we've sort of seen over, I'd say, about the last 15 years is a system that hasn't sort of started in the best of places, but has really been stretched to breaking point. There's several things which are going on. The big one that the Ombudsman's and everybody else points out is funding. Mm. We've got less funding. Well, I mean, ministers, particularly from the previous government, would have told you that there's more money going into the system, but there are more and more children who are kind of fitting the definitions of SEND, eligible and getting EHCPs, and therefore the kind of demand is going up. But the resources are not meeting the demand. So there's certainly a resourcing issue, and austerity has also played a part in this as well. But there are other factors as well, which our education system is sort of set up. It's not by design. It's just the way these things kind of shake out, that there are sort of perversions in the system which sort of reward schools for being non-inclusive, for not taking their fair share, if you like, of children who have special educational needs, and maybe directing them to the school down the road that they view as being more suitable for children. And there are incentives, in a sense, in the accountability system as well. Crudely put, the fewer children you have with special needs in your school, the more likely you'll do better in exam scores, and that'll be reflected in Ofsted grading. So the system sort of sets up odd behaviours, which I'm sure lots of school leaders would not kind of want to admit to doing. But unfortunately, there are some persistent offenders out there who contributing to this situation.
That's really interesting. I'm sure you saw this terrible report yesterday about abuse of autistic children that took place in a school in Walthamstow in East London. The BBC obtained footage of children at the school. These are autistic children being shoved into padded rooms, thrown to the floor or left alone, sitting in their own vomit. Number 10 has said the education department would look at strengthening the guidance on the use of seclusion in specialist schools and would set up more information as soon as possible. I hate to ask this, but is this sort of commonplace, this treatment of children with special educational needs?
I don't know about that particular case, Zoe, but it's not common. Mm. I would think. I don't know enough about it, so I'd be sort of a bit hesitant to say any more. But maybe one of the reasons why these come to light is because they are so extreme. But that's not, in my experience, that's the exception, not the norm.
Okay, well that's good to hear. You spoke a little bit about funding. Do you get a sense that also, I mean, we know that there is a funding crisis in schools, a funding crisis in local authorities that I mentioned as well, particularly being able to process applications. Do you also get a sense that maybe the teacher retention crisis has some role to play in this? I mean, is there a sense that there aren't simply in some schools enough teachers to not only look after all the students, but give students with those kind of special educational needs the support they need?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's been a persistent problem for a long time. And it's not just the levels of staffing, but it's the levels of confidence and competence that there are among teachers and existing and new teachers on how to best work with children with additional needs. So it's been quite a long-standing feature of our education system that special needs is not the priority when it comes to teacher training. So, and it's very variable as well. Some trainees will get some good grounding in special needs. Other trainees will get nothing at all. And then they might not get anything through the early part of their career either. It's very much kind of learning on the job. And there are other things that are sort of prioritised in teacher training, curriculum assessment, and so on. So in a sense, it's not just a numbers problem, but it's a, are we really skilling teachers up in the way we need them in order to be, effective with this particular group of children?
Mm. There is a lot of concern from various campaigners across the board about Labour's plan to impose VAT on private schools, because lots of special educational needs programmes are now sitting within private schools because of the cost to state schools to provide this kind of support. Are you worried about the impact this might have on families?
Not especially. I think with the kind of independent sector, those costs are borne by the local authority. So in a great deal of cases, it won't be a cost that's passed on to families. I'd be sort of concerned if that's what was the way it's going. But I don't know enough about those plans for VAT, but hopefully there are sort of sensible provisions being made. So, children who whose needs are best met in an independent setting, and there will be children who fit that description. They're not being unfairly discriminated against because of this idea about VAT.
And can you talk to me a little bit about how, if you are a child with SEND requirements, and you are not getting the support you need at an early age, how does this impact you in later life?
It can really reverberate, really. I suppose what we've got to see in the research is ways in which when things kind of get set up this way, they tend to stay that way. So if you are a child, a young child, you're entering school and you have additional needs, the likelihood is that you will be grouped with children who are very much like you. So a lot of your social interactions and experiences at school with children who also have special educational needs, or they might be sort of deemed lower attaining, or what's often kind of called low ability. That in a sense can, what we've seen in the research is once that sort of is embedded, it tends to carry on. So once you get into secondary school, you're very likely to be put in what is often termed the bottom set. So you're kind of working again with children who are very much like you. And that might actually bring some benefits because you can kind of tailor the lessons and the curriculum accordingly. Although again, what we see with children in this in these classes and in these kind of groups and sets is it's not always the case that the best teachers are put with these children. And therefore they kind of get a weaker teaching diet, if you like. And then there are statistics, I don't have them to hand, but I can kind of roughly kind of give you the shape of them. That children with special education needs are sort of overrepresented in kind of the justice system. Mm. You know, the link between poverty and special education is well established as well. So, you know, you kind of come out of school perhaps not with the opportunities that other children have, without the greatest experiences. The sort of priorities in school are generally centered around, you know, what I call typically developing children, the children without SEN. And so you just don't really get the same kinds of opportunities. And, you know, if you don't get the same kinds of opportunities, as I say, there are kind of knock-on effects as you're growing up, you know, and your prospects in the labour market and so on.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was Rob Webster, a writer in the field of special education needs and disabilities and author of the book, The Inclusion Illusion, How Children with Special Educational Needs Experience Mainstream Schools. Rob, thank you so much. That is it from Politics Uncensored today. What an interesting week. Lots to talk about. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we will be unwrapping the week's political talking points, hopefully with Ali back next to me. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Zoe_Grunewald, although not on X anymore. Find me on Blue Sky or Instagram. And if you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up on FubarRadio.com or on the FUBAR Radio app. Download it now from your app store. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald.